Most of these secret outfits, she said, had all kinds of specialized personnel to handle various assignments. I told her lots of people got killed doing that kind of work and it wasn't worth the risk and aggravation that goes with it. My mother reminded me that tens of thousands of American motorists die on the roads every year. When I made up my mind to join them, I was given an appointment in Rome at the end of November that year. I was told to go to Castel Sant'Angelo on a Saturday afternoon, to carry an umbrella and wear a red carnation in my lapel. Someone would contact me. As I waited for my contact to arrive at the designated location, a girl stopped, asking for directions. I gave them to her. She listened, then asked me to cross the bridge and go to a sidewalk cafe where I would be meeting a man wearing a hat and a blue and white coat. He was a young fellow, very pleasant and well-educated. He told me he was working as an international public relations man for a major American organization in Rome. I imagined a job interview like this was the beginning of a whole new adventurous career for someone like me. As I was a rambunctious young man, always in search of a new adventure, I accepted the job on the spot, without thinking about what I was getting myself into. We went to the 84 Club to drink a toast to my future. When we said goodbye that evening, he made me memorize an address and phone number in New York City, where I would be reporting sometime around the second week of January, 1969. That was the first time I heard the name Harold Barton. He was the man I was to report to during and after my training. I felt a lot better about the work when the young man assured me that in our work we don't get killed, we're not CIA agents. We just compile journalistic facts, calling M as we see M. I went to pick up my car, which was parked some soft hyphen where near Piazza di Spagna. I took a cab from Via Veneto, asking the driver to take me there. As I crossed the street I saw a red car approaching, fast. It was aiming right at me. I tried to run, but didn't make it to the other side of the street. The car hit me, throwing me some distance, then sped away into the night. I was in St. Giacomo Hospital in Rome for about 2 months. As far as I was concerned, that was the end of my short career as an international spy. I was pretty sure I was supposed to have been killed that night. The car very purposefully struck me. Although I eventually recovered from my injuries, I had no desire to ever be seen in public with those people again. It wasn't worth it. I got out of it fast. At least I thought I did. In August, 1970, I was picked up at a movie screening in Lima, Peru, by Harold Barton himself. He was mysterious and cautious. I was in no mood to listen to another spy story. I didn't even give the man a chance to explain the reason for his visit once he told me his name. I told him to take a flying leap as I was still feeling aches and pains in many bones of my body as a result of my Roman Odyssey 2 years earlier. He asked me to listen to him for just 5 minutes, and to try to be reasonable. I listened, but only to be polite. I was determined not to be any part of his operation. I wasn't eager to get killed. I was very impressed by this dignified man. And when the head man of a top secret organization comes to you personally and tells you that as a duty to your country, the least you could do is listen, you listen. This is what I remember of the conversation. Charles, I understand exactly how you feel, but this happens to be one of those special cases. It's true that I have the CIA, FBI, NATO and many other secret services working with us, agencies and agents that would make James Bond look elementary. So what do you want from me? He asked me if I remembered the names of 3 people. I said, yes, I do. I went to school with all of them, we were best buddies, real cut-ups. Charles, did you know they are in top positions in the Peruvian government? Yes, of course I know. Very well then. Now you know this is what makes you so valuable to us. But you're talking about my high school days. It's been more than 11 years since we've seen each other. You're lying. What do you mean? You were seen together at a party in March of this year. Hey, yes, you're right, I'd forgotten about that. I did see them for a few hours that night, 2 years ago. But I never remember men at an orgy. Excuse me, sir, How did you know about this, even about the party? Don't forget I'm the top man of this operation. I want you to realize that if there were another person in this world who could do the job, I wouldn't be here per soft hyphen sonally. I understood perfectly what he was saying. This was a one in a million chance. Three of my closest high school buddies and classmates were at that moment extremely influential and powerful in the government of a country where this Harold Barton was representing a lot of American enterprise and investments. He explained very carefully that he wasn't trying to recruit me as a regular. To prove it, he said there would be no training period. Reluctantly, I asked what my mission would be. Very simple. Just go to Peru, visit, socialize, party, wine, dine, and orgy with them. In your spare time, make sure you do some sightseeing. Is that all? That's it. Incredible. You'll be very safe, because I don't know of any cases of people getting killed for visiting and partying with old friends. How am I going to get in touch with them again? Last time we all got together was by some silly coincidence, after years of silence between us. You leave the details to me. I need you badly, and I can assure you you'll never regret this. I agreed to go ahead with it, with the assurance that I would be valuable to Harold on certain specialized assignments. During the last months of 1971, I spent time in Europe, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, being briefed by several companies that had heavy investments in the country where I was to be assigned. On January 15, 1972, I started my assignment, which was the beginning of a series of events that would eventually lead me to the country where I would meet Rama 2 years later. I made at least 5 trips to Peru, partying and having a good time with my ex-classmates. I also met Harold 2 or 3 times a year for tedious sessions of hard questioning. Our meetings could take place anywhere in the world. I'd get a plane ticket and instructions in the mail, designating a meeting place and a time, usually only a few days in advance. As always, secrecy and mystery were part of the set soft-up. I thought Harold was being overly dramatic, but since I felt that I had nothing to fear, I went along with all the mystery, continuing to move about freely. As far as I was concerned, the intrigue only added spice to the whole situation. Strangely enough, his questions were mainly about the people on the street, not my friends in government. He wanted to know what the average person thought of the government, what was the national mood, was there enough food and fuel supplies for those cities. He even asked about communications services, and if the news media covered the news as it really happened. He used to bring newspaper clippings of affairs in that country which had appeared in some American news soft-papers. I'd give him my unbiased impressions, knowing he always wanted me to go into great detail. At times, the questioning sessions left me with the feeling that he was trying to trick me into giving him answers. By 1972, I was going to various South American countries several times a year. Upon my return from each visit, I would give Harold my reports. By January 1, 1974, the relationships between the U.S. companies and Peru, the country where this story takes place, had gone sour, despite the efforts of American businesses to deal with the revolutionary government in Peru. By that time, I was no longer a spectator. I was taking an active part in the negotiations, trying to save some of the investments made by international corporations. By then, my activities no longer seemed mysterious, but legitimate international business, with all the headaches that go with it. The last time I saw the man I called Harold Barton alive was late May, 1974, at 3 o'clock in the morning at the Holiday Inn in Montreal, Canada. It was during this meeting he asked me to return to Peru around the middle of June that year. He wanted me to report to him on all the disturbances that would be taking place by the end of July, when the Peruvian government planned to take over all the news media in that country. It was while on this particular mission I met Rama in the Andes Mountains. On December 19, 1974, the day I drove to New York to see Harold Barton, breaking every speed law on the way, I still had no idea I would never see him alive again. When I couldn't see him, I decided to postpone my appearance at the Beverly Hills court, pending my return to the United States after working out Roy's Peruvian horse deal. I spent the Christmas holidays with Roy and Betty in Michigan. We used this time to put together the details on the venture. I was to go to Peru, buy the horses and return to Ohio. I would stay in Peru a couple of months to take care of the exportation procedures. By the end of March, I was to come back with the horses and stay at his Peruvian horse ranch in Ohio and write my book. Everything so agreed, I was on a Brinif flight from Miami to Lima, Peru, by January 2, 1975. I fastened my seat belt and let out a sigh of relief. This was the answer to my prayer, I thought. Some benevo-soft-lent spirit had picked up my mental images of going back to Peru and sprayed them with that thought material soft-hyphenizer. I arrived in Lima at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was a familiar face to immigration and customs officials. I entered the terminal and walked toward the car rental counters. I heard a familiar voice. "Can I get you a taxi, senor?" I turned around, dropping my luggage and briefcase, and ran to kiss and hug the beautiful creature who had called me. "Rama, you sweet baby, how did you know I was on this flight?" "Oh, never mind. How are you? How do I look?" "You look great. Let's rent a car and get out of this madhouse." There was so much I wanted to talk to her about, but it took me a few moments to recover from my surprise and excitement at seeing her appear at the airport to meet me. I didn't know where to start. Rama, always logical and full of common sense, calmed me down, saying, "Chaco, we have all day." She was wearing shorts, leather sandals, a man's shirt tied at the waist and a scarf on her head. As usual, nothing about her would lead anyone to suspect that she could be a humanoid from another planet. While we ate, I told her about the Peruvian horse deal that had made it possible for me to be back in Peru. "If everything goes according to schedule," I said, "I should be going back to the United States by the end of March. I have a list of horses to hunt down all over the place. Would you like to go with me?"
"Sure, why not?
That'll give us plenty of time to soft-hyphen-ther. In the next few days you take care of your business locally. When you're ready to begin your search, come to the medicinal baths and we'll travel looking for your horses. How's the book doing?" "I'm working out my notes, starting to make a skeleton copy."
"Is there any deadline as to when you would like to have it written and on the publisher's desk?"
"Well, I'm pretty sure it's going to be around the middle of 1976. But since our mission in this world is a joint effort, we'll have to consult with my brothers."
"Don't worry, you have plenty of time. Our sessions, as you call them, that we're going to have from here on in, are not to be written in this book of yours."
"I don't understand."
"Why?"
"Because we're methodical in our contact with Earth's intelligences. Just as you had to do a lot of work and study on what is yet to come, people have to make some preparations to meet extraterrestrials. By intelligent and careful observations as you have done. In other words, you don't want to contact people who aren't yet prepared to meet you. I'm talking about the psychological attitude of people when the existence of flying saucers as vehicles and intelligences from other worlds gets to be common knowledge." I really didn't understand why Rama wanted me to take my story only so far at the time, but as the year of 1975 went by I began to see why Rama had cautioned me about this. We spent the rest of the day together, making love, talking, and strolling on the beach like two lovers. January in Lima is the beginning of summer, and that evening, when the sun went down, Rama asked me to drive her to a nearby resort where I was going to drop her off to get her vimana. We went to a deserted area along the ocean. There was a cliff of about 500 feet. I got the car as close to the edge as possible. Before she left, Rama and I made plans to see each other up in the Andes Mountains in a few days, as soon as I straightened out my situation in Lima. A few minutes after Rama had gotten out of the car, I heard a smooth metallic sound and witnessed the sudden deeper soft-hyphen-ther of a flying disc. In moments it was lost in outer space, traveling at a fantastic speed. In the next few days, I took care of several business matters around Lima,
and scheduled a plan of action for contacting people who had Peruvian horses for sale. Around mid-January, 1975, I went back to Acaya. The trip was treacherous. Even though it was now the summer season, when you drive to Arz into the Andes Mountains, you encounter winter, with rain, snow and mud. The main central highway had become even worse than the last time I had traveled this road. It took me almost 6 hours to make the same trip that Inceptum Soft-Ba had taken me only 4. The only thing that was an improvement was I didn't have any altitude sickness this time. I got up early the next morning, fresh and rested, and checked my watch. It was 6:30, Tuesday, January 14. It was raining copiously, but I went down to the bathhouses anyway. I was looking forward with great anticipation to getting into that carbonated water again. It felt so good I stayed in the pool for about an hour. As I was having breakfast after my bath, I noticed a pickup truck dropping off someone. It was Rama. She'd hitchhiked a ride to meet me. A UFO was waiting for us nearby, she said. I couldn't believe my ears. Today I was going to take my first ride in a spaceship. We got into the Volkswagen and drove about 15 minutes toward Huanqiu. We came to a clearing, where she asked me to pull off the road. We got out of the car and Rama took me by the arm, leading the way. By then the rain had let up. As we walked, I saw something that resembled a small rain soft hyphen bow, very weak in intensity. She told me this was an electromagnetic field that surrounds the UFO's com soft hyphen pletli, thus making them invisible while standing on the ground. We were no more than 25 feet from the craft, and my eyes didn't see it. After we crossed the electrical frequency, it came into full view. This ship wasn't like the small Vimanas I'd seen previously. It had the same form and football-like shape, but it was much larger. It was metallic and seemed to have a silverish glow around it. As we approached the vehicle, which was resting on 3 metallic legs, Rama asked me to take off my shoes. I thought about Moses doing a something so many years ago on top of Mount Sinai. Rama explained that since my shoes were wet from the rain, and since water is a conductor of electricity, this would prevent me from getting a shock when I went into the ship. We were both given a pair of shoes, similar to sandals, made out of heavy wood. It looked more like cork. We climbed up a metal ladder that descended from a circular door. As I entered, I experienced a sudden change of temperature. It was a bit colder than the already cold Andes Mountains. The same kind of feeling one gets when entering an air-conditioned building, only some soft hyphen how this was stranger. 2 crew members, about 4.5 to 5 feet tall, greeted us in silence. They were wearing one-piece suits made of a shining gray material. It covered them from head to toe. There was no doubt they were humanoids. I began to feel extremely nervous and uncomfortable, an almost creepy feeling. Even though they were ex-soft hyphen trimly peaceful in their attitudes, I sensed I was safe with them, but still the fear of the unknown held me back. As soon as I advanced to more steps, I came face to face with the crew leader, standing inside an oval room about 25 feet in length, 15 to 20 feet wide, with about a 7-foot ceiling. Illumination came from all over the room, a red glow with a touch of orange. The crew leader had a nice face, with a benevolent expression. He had a long nose and slanted eyes that were elongated and extended around to the side of his head. I noticed he had no eyelashes and he didn't blink. But there was definitely eye activity. It took me a little while to figure out what made those eyes seem so alive. Then I noticed that his pupils narrowed and widened as he communicated with me. He got up from a triangular chair that was in front of some control panels, and walked over to receive us. Rama and the crew leader exchanged glances. It seemed as though the two of them had planned this visit. When he looked at me, I instinctively walked with him toward the control panel. His mouth tended to be still, but I could hear muffled words and sentences. It sounded as though he had a heavy accent. Sensing that I had difficulty understanding him, he changed his mode of communication. Suddenly, I could hear his voice speak soft hyphening to me inside my head, the same as when Rama and I had our mind-to-mind chats. He showed me around the craft. The instrument panels looked like a console one would find in a computer room. There were portholes all around the craft, and my host told me that we were in an observation UFO, with a crew of four. Up to this moment, I'd seen only two. By flicking a switch, a screen-like device lit up and we were able to see outside the spaceship where the other two crew members were. "Where do you come from?" I asked. "We're from a galaxy not too far from here," he said. He opened a scroll and I could see an oval map with many kinds of dots on it. He pointed at a group of stars, which he identified as the constellation of Daro, star Alcyone, the Pleiades. He located our own sun, then he showed me his home planet on a map, which appeared to be nothing more than a bunch of dots to me. He told me they had bases on Mars and Venus. "What about here on Earth?" I asked. "Not our bases, but UFO bases that all of us are cooperatively keeping here on Earth. It's our mission as peaceful intelligences to maintain the balance of the universe. With our terrestrial bases, we can keep an eye on you. In a few minutes, we're going to see one of the bases here in South America, but first you must tell Rama where you want your car." I turned to Rama, who was observing my reactions, and told her I was supposed to go to a city called Trujillo and another called Chiclayo, both located on the North Soft-Earn coast of Peru, 500 miles north of Lima. Somehow they hooked the VW up to the UFO. I could see it on the screen. The thought hit me, what would the car rental company think if they knew that one of their cars made the 800-mile trip to Chiclayo in about 9 minutes? When we were ready for takeoff, Rama exchanged some information with the crew leader, then I was placed between them. "This machine is operated through reversible soft-tromagnetism," she explained. "See those columns go soft-ing to that rotor that looks like transparent plastic?" "Yes," I said, nodding. "Well, those are reactors. When the mercury in that rotor gets going at full speed, we can reverse the magnetic and electrical energy. That way we can control matter and also overcome the forces of gravity." When we took off, I felt a great force pulling my face muscles back. Even my arms and shoulders were pushed flat against the chair. Rama told me not to worry because that was due only to the great speed we were experiencing. We hovered for a while over an old road that led to the Pan American Highway, near a little town not far from the city of Chiclayo. I didn't get out of the aircraft. The crew unloaded the VW, and Rama said we would leave it there for an hour or two. Later she and I would come back in a Vernana, which was a smaller craft enough for two or three people. We ascended again, but at a lesser speed, flying over the Andes Mountains, once more at an extreme altitude. I could see some commercial jetliners way below us as tiny specks of light, their surfaces and expanded wings reflecting the sun. As we descended gradually, I saw in the distance a great expanse of water. Rana said it was the Titicaca Lake and that we would be entering it. My eyes opened wide as I saw the lake approaching. I was expecting some kind of crash or a marked change as we penetrated the surface tension of the water, but it was a smooth entry, nothing resembling a crash. We traveled underwater, the UFO navigating like a sophisticated submarine, until we came to a UFO base under the lake, which was like a whole city. The crew leader said this was the base that Rana had told me about when I first met her. Suddenly we were in the air again. The only sensation I felt during this transition was a slight change in density. As we flew through the clouds, I saw ice-covered mountains in the distance. I recognized them as the icy peaks found about 25 miles from Huancayo and saw the Mantaro Valley with its river slicing through the center of it. We landed close to the ice peaks, where Rana's Vernana was waiting for us. I thanked the crew leader for the tour. He said we would see each other again in a few days. Rama and I flew to Chiclayo then, in a Vimana that had been left hidden behind some sand hills. When we returned to where the car had been left earlier, I was still in the daze. It was hard to believe I had flown in two UFOs. It had been the experience of my life. Chapter 16. Finally believing. Our horse hunt was great. In 2 days I managed to photograph every possible horse that Roy might want to buy, plus a few extra I'd found on my own. Roy had given me an XL70 Polaroid camera, which produced color photographs within minutes. As if this process weren't speedy enough, Rama suggested we get in the Vimana, hit the U.S., and drop them off at some mailbox. That way, Roy would have the photos the next day. When she mentioned this, I had a better idea. Why don't we take them to Roy directly? I asked. Rama gave me one of her sad looks and told me to remember what the crew leader had told me about motherships and terrestrial UFO bases. You must realize that some people in your world can't handle things like that. We don't mind telling you where our bases are located, but I asked you when you came to Peru not to reveal this information. Other people, other contactees, will take care of getting that to the media. What do you mean, other contactees? People like you who'll be contacted now and in years to come. When we talked about the Silence Group, you remember we said a lot about UFO information being restricted by the media. There are, however, two organizations in the US, APRO and NICAP, who work to disseminate this kind of information. Yes, I know. Aerial Phenomena Research Organizer Soft-Shin and the National Committee on Aerospatial for Soft-Nimina. I checked them both very thoroughly as soon as I got back to the States. I came across another such organization, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network of Quincy, Illinois. There are so many books on UFOs that I 338 would have been convinced even if I'd never met you or had this experience. Good. Now I want you to listen to me and pay attention, because this is important. The purpose of writing this book is not the reporting of UFO sightings. From now on, you and I and my friends from other worlds are going to be seeing a lot of each other. You'll be getting in and out of spacecraft, you'll see motherships and more of our UFO bases on Earth. Don't write about it, because most of it has been written already. Besides, you said yourself that they wouldn't believe you anyway. That's right. What I'd like you to do is write about our conversus soft hyphensions. Let's hope those few who choose to believe you, do so out of conviction, after they've corroborated it with the reading suggestions we're going to give them. Maybe then they'll be able to accept that some people, human beings from other planets, are already here to fight evil forces that are working to take full control of your planet. That's the purpose of the message. I see. I was already thinking how I could actually sit down and write the things that happened this morning, flying all over America in minutes. You and I are going to be studying some more. Now you have two advantages, one your astral projection, and the other the fact that we can move freely in our own Vimana. Oh, wow. I really enjoy that. Why did I get so lucky? You've earned it by taking the time to check it out. You didn't expect me to write about these XPRISOFT-ENSES without checking them thoroughly? Did you? I consider myself to be a serious person and very straight with my work. Remember, I'm a journalist. Yes, I know that, my friends know that. But some people in your world think you're a suspicious character, and a con man. I read you loud and clear. To some people I'm the biggest idiot. But that's part of my cover. I actually enjoy putting on a show to make people think I'm ignorant. Then I get a thrill when they find out otherwise. I know what you mean. Now, going back to your friend Roy, I don't think it would be a good idea to take the pictures to him by Vimana. Why not? Because I feel someone is going to set you against Roy. Come on, row not with Roy. He's the only reason I was able to come back to Peru. These horses are his, and I'm the only man who can get them out of Peru in no time. You'll see. He's very interested in seeing this book of ours written. He's going to help me with it. He's even offered to let me stay at his ranch in Ohio while I write, so I can have peace and quiet. Do you know what he got me for Christmas? Let's see. Never mind. Not fair reading minds. Among other things, you got a book you wanted badly. Satan in the Sanctuary. You'll see, he was definitely touched by it. When it happens, you'll see. But don't worry about it, just continue living, loving God and your neighbor, Live in harmony with everyone and your wishes will come true. I always act in good faith. What you call being a good Christian is what I call being a gentleman. If Roy does a number on me, I'll continue praying by making teddy bear images with life, shape and movement. Then you spray, and boom. They become real.